This is Classic Business with Michael Avery on Classic 1027 in Gauteng and FMR in Cape Town.
Well, it ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. It's a quote often misattributed to Mark Twain. In fact, if you do the research, no one really knows who said it. But it's very fitting to open tonight's panel debate on the state-owned elephant in the room, Eskom, which has spawned two white elephants in the form of Medupi and Kasili. And what we need to do as a country to get ourselves out of this mess. Now, since President Ramaphosa announced last Thursday that Eskom would be unbundled into three entities, generation, transmission and distribution, there's been a lot of finger pointing, a lot of posturing, and even some unlikely alliances being formed. But tonight I'd like us to try to steer clear of the finger pointing and try to focus on finding solutions, because really as a country that's what we need to do in order to get ourselves out of this mess. We need to find each other across the table, and with that I'd like to welcome tonight's panelists, Dr. Tobias Bischoff-Nemps, CEO of Innertrag South Africa and former head of the CSIR division, energy division. Great pleasure having you finally in studio. We've chatted telephonically a few times.
Thanks, good evening. Good to be here.
On the line, we've got Phakamile Hlubi-Majola, national spokesperson for NUMSA. Phakamile, thanks for joining us.
Evening, and thank you for having me.
And also in studio, Sean Nell, project director at the Energy Intensive Users Group of Southern Africa, which represents some of the largest energy users, as you've gathered from the title. Sean, good to see you.
Good evening.
Now, Tobias, I think high level we've analysed the problem statement to death. We saw in the presentation in Parliament by the DPE today, the talk is of Eskom being technically insolvent, ceasing to exist in its current form by April 2019. Of course, I don't think it could ever be technically insolvent, because ultimately the losses will be socialised and taxpayers will end up footing the bill. But it's got unsustainably high levels of debt, $420 billion on that, that's 15% of the sovereign debt. The cash that's generating doesn't cover operating and debt servicing costs. There's the municipal issue, and how do we get municipalities to pay? And also, the employee numbers have increased from 32,000 to just over 48,000 in the last 11-odd years, and costs there have more than trebled. So we know what the issues are. To fix this, the president announced the unbundling in his State of the Nation address. It's a vertical unbundling. We have horizontal unbundling too. Just explain how vertical unbundling will seek to start to address some of these structural issues inside Eskom.
So vertical unbundling essentially means that you cut Eskom along the value chain. You cut it into three pieces. Transmission piece, that's where the large highest voltage transmission lines are designed, run and operated. Generation, that's in essence the coal fleet, plus a little bit of additional power generators, and then distribution. These are the final lines that bring the power at the end of the day to the end customer. Why does that help? Well, it helps because at the moment, everything, all these functions are already ring-fenced and isolated within Eskom, but Eskom is one legal entity. There is internal transfer pricing between these different functions. However, if you are within one legal entity, it's relatively easy to move budgets, to move responsibilities, to move accountability from one place to the other, because it's within one org chart of one legal entity. As you cut it into three pieces, just by the sheer fact that you introduce three different legal entities, it's now much more difficult to move something from transmission into generation or vice versa that doesn't belong there. So that in itself creates transparency and accountability, and both are very important features that have been lacking for a long time in the Eskom context.
There was an article published in the Cape Argus, I think, one of the independent newspapers today. The headline was rather clumsy because it was quoting the ANC as being against the unbundling. In effect, what Ace Magashula was saying is the ANC are against privatization. Unbundling is not privatization. You're saying effectively that you're just getting more line of sight and accountability through three separate legal entities.
Absolutely, and it's not new. China actually did exactly what is now being proposed in 2002 already, and has run its electricity system very successfully with that unbundling. And that unbundling had absolutely nothing to do with privatization. It was a simple cutting it into pieces, and they did the vertical unbundling and horizontal unbundling on a generation site at the same time, introduced a number of state-owned generation companies that own the generation assets, the power stations, and compete with each other. And they have introduced State Grid Corporation, which today is the second largest company in the whole world with 1 million employees, and that runs, builds, and operates the Chinese transmission grid. And I don't see any reason why the Eskom success story on the grid side could follow exactly that example, not just for South Africa, but also for the region.
Now, Pakamile, Labour is understandably worried inside Eskom about jobs, worried in the coal mining sector about its constituents there, and that is understandable. But as the economy bleeds roughly 2 billion rand per day because of this crisis, depending on which way you slice and dice the numbers, I was in shops today that were turning customers away because of load shedding. I think the risk is greater to all of the workers of the country rather than to narrowly focus on workers inside Eskom in the coal sector. What are your main concerns around the move towards an unbundled Eskom? Because as we've seen, Eskom's monopolistic structure is unusual by international standards. It's exposed itself to various maladies, bloated costs, poor governance, corruption, all of those things quite clearly need to be done away with. Why would you want the status quo to continue inside Eskom?
Thank you for having me. First of all, we do not want the status quo to continue. We said we oppose the unbundling of Eskom because it will lead to privatization. What we have been very consistent on as unions, but in particular as NUMSA, is that the situation at Eskom cannot go on as it has been going on up until this point. Now, to pick up on the point that was made by your guest in relation to the benefits of unbundling. He talks about how this unbundling will result in transparency. And it's interesting because for us, the way we see it, surely the simpler solution here is that you reconstitute the board of the SOE to truly represent the stakeholders of this country, who are the working class. So in other words, the board must represent labor, it must be representative of community, and it must be representative of business and government. That's the transparency that you're going to get when you do that through Eskom. Unbundling of Eskom is privatization. When the ANC has been talking about privatization for a long time, and even when you look at the NDP,
they've identified... How? Can you give me an example?
I'll explain to you.
Please, but
because even in the SONA, the president talks about the sale of non-core assets. Who's going to buy those non-core assets? Private companies are going to buy those non-core assets. Already at Eskom, they have identified, for example, the call center, the national call center, which is staffed by hundreds of people. They have identified that as a non-core asset, which is going to be privatized. So we are not under any illusion. We know what this government is saying when they talk about the unbundling of Eskom. And there's nobody who's going to try and convince us otherwise, because this political party has been talking about privatization, and they speak about it even in the NDP as one of their goals. And this is exactly what they're doing through this process.
Pakamile, so in effect, are you saying that if the board of Eskom is reconstituted to reflect the working class demographics of the country, we will solve its debt crisis and the energy crisis with which the country is confronted and threatens the jobs of millions of South African working class citizens?
That is one of the starting points. You're
is
talking
that what
about
you say?
The lack of transparency. Yes.
Okay.
We're talking
okay.
about the
Fantastic.
Lack of transparency.
I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you. I just like the next speaker to enter the conversation. Thank you for your opening introductory remarks, Sean. From the view of the energy intensive users group, obviously the big question that still hasn't been answered is how any unbundling will solve for Eskom's 420 billion rand debt mountain. If you look at it, it seems like the bulk of Eskom's value is in its generation, transmission and distribution, probably around between 10 and 20%, one would say between 80 and 90% of the value in generation. So a lot of the debt, call it 370, 380 billion odd, will sit on that balance sheet. Someone's got to pay for it. And that seems to be in the form of higher tariffs, and that'll impact your users. What do you make of that scenario?
I mean, there's so many different issues we're bundling up in a couple of discussion points. So the first thing is, unbundling is not going to solve the issue, but it's a step towards solving the issue. What unbundling allows Eskom to start doing is, for example, engaging in individual long-term contracts with particularly industrial customers. I mean, Tobias was mentioning that the distribution then provides energy to the customers. Well, actually, 40% of the customers take their energy straight off the transmission network and not the distribution network. So by unbundling, we can actually start giving Eskom some opportunities to contract with industrial customers for a long-term fixed-price contract, which will give them clarity on their own revenues. It'll give the industrial customers certainty about their pricing and security of supply, which will save jobs in those sectors, which I think the unions also often forget. We talk about unbundling and losing jobs in Eskom, but let's not forget miners, industrial job workers, people in smelting, manufacturing, which have been shedding jobs for the last couple of years in a significant amount of value. And I must say, I am concerned that Labour seems to have forgotten those people who in the productive sector are no longer employed.
Tobias?
Well, I think the purpose of the electricity sector is first and foremost to provide reliable electricity at the lowest possible cost. And by doing that, it grows the economy and creates jobs in all the sectors that were just mentioned. However, in the specific case, in the transition that we are confronted with, we are not just talking unbundling and structural changes, we also have huge technological changes ahead of us at the very same time where we have the unbundling and the crisis discussion. The positive news is that even within the electricity sector, the move towards a renewables-based power system will actually create more jobs in the electricity sector itself, which is not really the purpose of the electricity sector, but it's just a positive side effect.
Give me an example of that, because I know the big concern has been if we were to move jobs away from coal into renewable energy, that there would be a net decline in jobs. You've looked at the numbers in the IRP and actually found that through the CapEx and the OpEx cycle, there's going to be a net gain in jobs.
Exactly. So renewables, that is globally through many empirical data, empirical studies, it's clear that the renewables business is a more job-intensive business than coal and nuclear-based, the traditional forms of power generation. In the U.S., for example, the U.S. Department of Energy has done a very intense labor study, job study along the entire value chain of all energy sectors. And in the U.S., in 2018, as we speak, we're 475,000 people work in solar and wind along the entire value chain, compared with 240,000 people in coal and nuclear combined. So that's twice the number, taking into account the fact that wind and solar only provide 10% of the electricity in the US, while coal and nuclear provide 60%. So very clear indication of the higher job intensiveness. The problem is often that, why is that not seen? It's not seen because the jobs in the traditional energy supply industry are highly concentrated. It has to do with the nature of fossil fuels. Fossil fuels are in one location and not spread across the whole country. That's why you have coal mining jobs, oil jobs in one area. Renewables jobs, you harvest wind, you harvest the sun, are by nature spread across the whole country. So you don't see the jobs as you see them in the Mpumalanga, in the Middleburg, in the Imatleni
in the
area.
Coalfield.
Exactly, yeah. In the coal field. So, but there's a net gain. Net gain is irrelevant to the individual coal miner. Yeah? So it's society that needs to make sure that the net gain arrives in the areas that are negatively affected, which is coal mining areas.
And how do we do that? How do we ensure, Pakamile, from your perspective, how would you like to, through an energy transition, ensure that government helps labour through this transition? I know in Mauritius, for example, there's a program where if anyone in the public sector loses their job, there is a fund set up to take them through an incubation period, to a three-month incubation period set up by government to acquire a new skill, or there is a cash incentive as well to almost just take the money and run. But we can innovate. I mean, that's an example of how we can innovate and help workers through the transition. Are you having these sorts of conversations?
Well, for us, the problem here is that for this to happen in a way that is, first of all, sustainable. And when we say sustainable, we're talking about a situation where workers do not lose their jobs, where employment is created, and where the energy price does not go up. That would mean following the principles of a just transition. And even though we've been hearing the president use that term, he's frankly perverted the definition of what a just transition is. A just transition is a process where the transition from fossil fuels, from the dependence on fossil fuels, is driven for the benefit of the working class and in their interest. It's a process that depends heavily on genuine social dialogue and engagement, where the benefits of the renewable energy project are directly accrued by the community, where the ownership thereof is owned by the community. And as Minsa, we're one of the very few trade unions in the world that even has a policy on this, on renewable energy, where we're calling for just transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy, and that these technologies must be owned and controlled by the communities and the working class. The problem here is that we are transitioning from fossil fuel to renewable energy. This process has been done without any consultation of the working class. It is not beneficial, certainly, to the majority of people. We know for a fact that in Mpumalanga, 100,000 coal jobs will be lost. The CSIR confirmed this in their research. And the government has made no social plan for what will happen to those workers who are connected to the value chain of industries which are connected to the coal sector in Mpumalanga. This will exacerbate the unemployment crisis that we have in this country. And this is why, as Munsa, we have consistently repeated that this project is disastrous, because ultimately it's going to have a very, very negative impact on our country, and particularly on the economy of Mpumalanga.
Tobias, 100,000 jobs lost in Mpumalanga?
Well, that number it comes from the CSIR. That is correct. It relates to direct and indirect jobs in the coal mining sector. So it's not the coal miners as such, but it's coal miners plus all the other economic activities that you have. And a lot of indirect activities are activities that are not necessarily linked directly to coal mining. If you have a spurs, for example, in a coal mining area, that's an economic activity with an indirect job, but it's not directly linked to coal mining. So that's the total number. The problem, however, with that number is that the CSIR is saying these 100,000 jobs, direct and indirect — I prefer to look at direct only because it's very tangible — but these jobs will be lost not because of introduction of alternative energy sources, no matter what the alternatives are. They will be lost because the coal stations that are affecting these jobs are so old that they will be ramped down. That was planned for 10, 15 years already. So I agree with my colleague here that this is something that could have been planned 10 years ago already. I 100% agree on that side. The thing is, this will have, because these power stations, as we see through the load shedding at the moment, are not available to produce power anymore. They will shut down either in a controlled manner through controlled decommissioning, or in an uncontrolled manner, which is to some extent what we see at the moment. So that problem is there, and it will not go away if we don't implement alternative energy sources. It will just be worse, because if we don't implement alternative energy sources, we will have the load shedding for longer than necessary, and we will not have any of the new jobs, and still have the 100,000 direct and indirect lost.
I think that sums it up. Sean, on the issue of collaboration, and this comment out of the president's sonar was that he's looking to build pragmatic and cooperative relationships, is the president, between government, organized labor, and the private sector. And he says here, where we can jointly determine a strategic path for SOEs to create jobs, enable inclusive economic growth, and become operationally and financially sustainable. And to that, the minister in Parliament today added that there have been numerous engagements with business and with organized labor to address the crises as they've emerged, but that a presidential coordinating council on SOEs has had its terms of reference approved by cabinet, and the composition of that council is being finalized. So it sounds like there is being a consultation planned, and it is going to be broad-based.
Well, I think the first thing we have to recognize is that we cannot operate independently, Labour, government, or business. It cannot be just Labour and business. It cannot be just Labour and government. It is a tripartite arrangement. Business requires Labour. Labour requires business to be employed. And business requires all of them to be able to, government requires all of them to be able to execute the economy. So it is a critical that we come together to understand each challenge and how we overcome those challenges. And it's something that business has been calling for many years, an economic codessa on how we address the structural issues of the economy, how we structure the issue of transition, how we address the concerns from both labor and business. And I think that's critically important because SOEs are critical to the success of the country and business, and we have to recognize that.
And just to stay on the business side of things for a second longer, Pakamila, before I go back to you, there's some important regulatory issues outstanding here as well. For example, I was talking to Kieran White this week, who's a project finance attorney, about corporate PPAs, and we had the Granny Smith announcement by Goldfields last week, and they decided to go into Australia before South Africa, even though they've got similar challenges, because they said the regulatory environment is more welcoming for a corporate PPA in Australia. So that's low-hanging fruit, surely, Sean, for us to help business find its own solutions in the state of a crisis that is crippling this economy.
Well, 100%. You know, the issue is we often talk about single issue, like problems in South Africa. Every department or every focus area or crisis moment thinks that their issue is the single point of... for business, we see them all. We see environmental, we see regulatory, we see electricity issues. And that's where we call for this like integrated discussion, because as business, we are seeing the challenges from all the points. Every government department sees it from one point. And that's why our traditional advantage was our cheap electricity, which allowed us to compete internationally. But if without the stable electricity and cheap prices, all those other regulatory burdens now become an issue. And that's why companies are looking elsewhere for investment. And until we can address policy coherence, regulatory coherence, and creating a competitive environment here, people are not going to invest.
Pakamila, back to the issue of interacting with government on this and ensuring that all the social partners in the tripartite sort of alliance are aligned on this. The minister mentioned that the terms of reference have been approved by cabinet for this presidential coordinating council on SOEs, and the composition is being finalized now. So surely talks and consultations will follow shortly thereafter, which seems to indicate that this government is not promising empty promises via the rhetoric that you mentioned earlier, and is going to commit to consultation and openness.
But that's not true. First of all, NIMSA is not part of the tripartite alliance.
No, just to elaborate on that, when I mentioned tripartite alliance, I meant it in the sense of government, business and labour, not in the political sense.
No problem. But even in relation to that, there has been no consultation. In fact, what we're finding as Labour, NUMSA, even though we're not part of the ANC's tripartite alliance, we are a recognised union at ESCOM. And together with the NUM, as recognised unions at the state-owned entity, there's been absolutely no discussion, conversation or consultation about the future of ESCOM. Most of what we've been hearing has been on media, through media reports, statements and comments which I issued like 2 weeks ago when the Minister of Public Enterprises went and basically confirmed that they were going to unbundle ESCOM. All of that's been taking place without even speaking to Labour. So the way we see it, whatever consultation is going to take place now is just a box-ticking exercise. The decision has already been made. In fact, it was made long ago. And all they want is for Labour to endorse what they have already decided. And because we were not there, this will not be to our benefit at all. They've already made decisions about which capitalist entities are going to benefit through this privatization, which will take place after ESCOM has been unbundled. The impact will be thousands of jobs lost at ESCOM, and to make matters worse, our energy prices are going to increase, because even in the SONA, the president confirmed that this is what we can expect.
Tobias, in 30 seconds, what would you do right now with Kusile? Do we cut our losses on that?
I think Kusile is probably in a status where the residual amount of money that still needs to spend is higher than the value that the power station has to the system. So it's probably best to stop it.
Well, there we go. In 10 seconds, it's not rocket science. Dr. Tobias Bischoff-Nemtz, CEO of Innotrack South Africa, thank you very much. Phakamile Klubi-Majola, National Spokesperson for NUMSA, and Sean Nell, Project Director for the Energy Intensive Users Groups of Southern Africa. Thank you for tuning in to the show tonight. If you had power, count yourself as one of the lucky ones. The redoubtable Kianete Fortwane is up next in the lounge for our Cape Town listeners. And in Gauteng, the sultry sounds of Carolyn Stain's Classic Cocktails. Till tomorrow, good night.